Good morning and welcome to this month's Hancock Horizon Investments Economic Update Call. Hancock Horizon Investments provide this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have any questions, please email them to david_lundgren@hancockhorizon.com and he'll take them at the end of the call. Today, we have investment directors Jeffrey Tangus, Greg Hudleski, and Richard Chauvin, and David Lundgren, our Chief Investment Officer, will be the moderator.
Great. Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining. John Portwood is on vacation, so I'm going to kick things off with a brief discussion about the economy. And for those that have been listening, really for years on this call, we've talked about the slow growth environment that we've been in since the financial crisis. There's been a change in trend, and I guess, you know, time will tell if it's truly a change in trend or is it just a blip. We've had kind of fits and starts over the last 8 years in terms of the economy, but a pretty solid third quarter, and I'll discuss the details, and things are a bit encouraging in the fourth quarter to this point. So before the third quarter, if you think about the three preceding quarters, which would be the fourth quarter 2015 and then the first half of 2016, GDP was right around 1%, pretty anemic growth, and pretty similar to what we've experienced the last 8 years. But the third quarter initial reading that we talked about last month came in a bit more positive at 2.9%. And then just late last month, that number was revised to an even better 3.2%, really, and the reason being more consumer spending. So that was encouraging. So we had a pretty good backdrop as we headed into the fourth quarter. And as we're headed into the fourth quarter, a little bit more than two-thirds through, it seems that that positive tone has continued. Both leading and coincident indicators have trended higher. And I guess of all the data that I've looked through, the number that really sort of jumped off the page was the Economic Surprise Index. And if you're not familiar with the ESI, it's produced daily, and it shows the degree to which economists under or overestimate the trends in the business cycle. And since about mid-November, if you look at this chart, it's hard to do it on a conference call to truly get an appreciation of where we've been and where we are now. That chart is going pure vertical. Right around November 15th or so, each day that a new number has come out, we've seen a more and more positive trend. So that's really encouraging. It's obviously not the only indicator that we want to look at, but it gives you some sense of the tone and where we are just from a pure economic standpoint. I guess some additional data points of interest. The Purchasing Managers Index, which has been a pretty reliable indicator of the health of the economy over the years. And just to give you a little background on how that index works, each month, ISM, or the Institute for Supply Management, interview 300 purchasing manager executives across the country. They're surveyed monthly and on different things, new orders, pricing power, et cetera. And this month, or the December 1 number that was released, the index came in at 53.2, and that's the highest monthly reading since early 2015. So pretty encouraging news there. And then lastly, looking at jobs or employment. And this is a number, obviously, the Fed will focus on. We're going to talk about the Fed in a little bit. But the headline number, the unemployment rate, dropped to 4.6%. And that's the lowest since 2007. And I know we've talked about it on this call. There's a lot of, talk in the media about how realistic that number is. But if you also look at the U.S. 6 underemployed number and you factor in labor participation rates, the U6 underemployed rate is 9.3%, which is obviously a much bigger number, but that's also the lowest that it's been since 2008, early 2008, late 2007. So, you know, I guess that the key takeaway from a job standpoint is we're definitely seeing some firmness. We're not necessarily seeing it in wage prices, But the labor market is getting tight. Again, another positive sign. And then lastly, John Portwood talks about this. We don't know. Obviously, a lot of people are estimating the fourth quarter. We had a weaker trade number this morning that might drag that down a little bit. But I think the general consensus is that there's a good chance that fourth quarter we see yet another 3%. The Atlanta Fed GDP now, John Portwood talks about this just about every month. It's a forecasting model. As data comes in, they go ahead and revise or change the model. And as of December 1st, that was the last reading, their number was 2.9%. We're going to see another reading sometime this morning, and we'll see what that looks like. But again, you know, definitely a more positive tone from an economic standpoint. So after that rather upbeat report, I want to make sure that everybody understands, you know, this is not popping champagne and singing happy days are here again, but we're cautiously optimistic about where we are. And as we head into 2017, it's definitely a more upbeat or positive tone than what we've experienced, you know, really for sure, you know, the last year or two. And then you can even draw that out all the way to the last 8 years since the financial crisis. So with all that said, Greg, I'm going to turn to you for a minute. And obviously we had a big election last month and with somewhat surprising results. And at least from a market standpoint, you know, that really seemed to serve as a pivot point for both stocks and bonds. And we're going to talk about the stock market and the bond market in a minute. And obviously the election, you know, didn't have any impact on the third quarter, which was positive, nor did it have any impact on that first 6 weeks. But that positive trend has continued. And I know in this business, causation is always difficult to identify. But has the election results helped this more positive tone or the economic output that we've seen to this point?
I think the election may have played a small part in the rally, or maybe just the simple fact that the election was over helped fuel the market. I think there was a lot of election fatigue on both sides, and I think, you know, as we've mentioned in the past, markets hate uncertainty. And although as we approach the election, you need to remember that the favorite to win was Clinton. And it was widely believed that a Trump win would actually cause the market to sell off because he was the relatively unknown quantity. And actually, once it was announced that he won in the early hours of Wednesday morning, the day after the election, global markets did sell off, and it was said, a lot of market pundits came out, that the U.S. would open down, probably creating a possible 10% correction. But over the next 6 to 7 hours from the announcement, when markets opened, it actually, the futures turned positive, and that sell-off never happened. The market continued to keep going. I was looking at a price chart of the small-cap Russell 2000 Index, and it actually bottomed and turned up sharply on November 3rd, 5 days before the election. Now, that could just be anticipatory of just the election being over and that it was a done deal. But ultimately, the markets really reflect the health of the economy, and I think the election was probably just some noise that was introduced. And with the third quarter GDP number coming in at slightly over 3% as you managed versus the very anemic first half, the markets took that very positively, and perhaps that growth is resuming. Another interesting thing is that small caps generally are very strong coming out of a recession because they tend to be more leveraged to the economic cycle, and perhaps their strong relative performance. And just for example, I took a look at the total return from the 1st of January through June 30th, and the Russell 2000 was up 2.2%, you know, very flat. If you take the next five months, from June 30th through November 30th, it's up 15.42. So clearly, the market, or at least small cap stocks, seem to be reacting like they're coming out of a recession. And although we were not in a recession, it was a soft spot, low levels of growth. BD estimates going forward, I think, as you pointed out, are still hovering around 2%. But then again, we were thinking that that was going to be the same case this year, and, you know, we've had some surprises. Another positive aspect that points to possible stronger growth and a reason for the market again is the ISM Index, which is the Institute of Supply Management, which surveys firms to determine the state of business conditions, inventories, hiring, so on and so forth. And the most recent release on the service side of the economy, which is where predominantly most of the people work, reported that more businesses are expanding instead of contracting. Another indicator that takes a slightly different approach by actually looking at the hard numbers instead of surveying firms, and you mentioned that, is the PMI. It looks at inventories, production, hiring, et cetera. It is also up strongly since about April, very sharply up. It also implies that business seems to be picking up. Some of our research firm, Strategus, is gauging the economy for 2016 with a 60% probability of economic expansion, 15% chance of even stronger upside growth, and a 25% chance of a negative shock. For 2017, we're still looking for a 60% chance of expansion, so, you know, a bias towards growth, which is good, a 20% chance of stronger expansion, so a little bit slightly higher probability there, and 20% for a negative shock. As you said, the one thing that hopefully that this is actually the start of something sustainable and not just a cyclical peak again. It could turn around and go right back down. Hopefully that's not the case, but I think those, the underlying economics are the real drivers. I think at one point perhaps the negative nature, I think the market was a little bit concerned about whether the campaigning protectionist Trump would actually dominate, or whether the pro-growth Trump would dominate, and perhaps a lot of that discussion was had in the market, and Wall Street decided that he's going to focus on the pro-growth campaign and less so on the protectionist measures. So that's, I think, the underlying explanation.
I think there's also a fair amount of optimism regarding tax reform, and I'm going to ask Richard to talk about that in a minute. But before we do that, Jeff, do you have anything that you want to add in terms of just economic growth, or should we move on to Richard and tax reform?
Just two quick comments. Excuse me. First of all, the third quarter was a real good quarter economically, even you know, obviously before the election. There were some anomalies that took place in the third quarter. There was a really poor soybean harvest in South America. We exported a great deal of soybeans that showed up in our exports, which was a little unexpected and made the third quarter look strong, but it was a bit of an anomaly. So I think the third quarter was good going into the election anyway, but there were a few strange things that were in the numbers there if you look beneath the surface. My take on the economy and the election, certainly the markets reacted, you know, with exuberance, using Greenspan's old term. My thought on that is it wasn't necessarily just that Trump was elected, although obviously that was a surprise, but it was also what took place in the House and the Senate and the fact that the Republicans were able to claim a much stronger majority than people had anticipated. And the effect of that is going to be much less gridlock. In my estimation, that probably is what the market really focused on, is the fact that you've got a clear majority. There are a couple roadblocks with, I guess there's still a couple things that Democrats could filibuster, but for the most part, there is a great reduction in Washington gridlock. Now, that can go both ways. Sometimes bad things can happen and sometimes good things can happen. Clearly, the market is anticipating pro-business things taking place, and I think that's a reasonable assumption. But in my estimation, that's really what the market sees in this election that is different than what people anticipated going into the election.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. And And as I mentioned earlier, I think there's also, you know, there's optimism regarding less regulation, which could be a positive environment for businesses. But also tax reform has been a big issue throughout the campaign and has been much talked about since the end of the election. And Richard, if you could talk a little bit about, you know, there's a lot of different scenarios being thrown out there in terms of tax reform. Talk a little bit about the possibilities and what impact it might have on the economy and markets. You might be on mute, Richard.
Sorry, Dave. Thank you very much. And so I'm going to focus mainly on corporate tax reform today, but before I do that, certainly the interest that everybody has in individual tax cuts and tax reform is probably quite high. So on that front, individual tax cuts are more difficult to achieve in the budget process and certainly in the political process, but I'll make a few comments about that, and I suspect that in future calls, we're going to be talking a lot more about the individual tax cuts, and which everybody has a great deal of interest in. On that particular package, there's a Congress under Speaker Ryan has worked up a package of tax cuts of the on the individuals that would collapse the seven brackets down to three, and President-elect Trump has the same brackets in his talking points and plans as well. Those brackets would go 12%, 25%, and 33%. So that reduces the complexity of the current seven-bracket system. The difficulty on that would be that doing so would require probably limitations on some significant itemized deductions, and that's where the difficulty with lobbyists come in. There's going to be a lot of sacred cows there that have to be dealt with. So there's in terms of timing of individual tax reform, some forecasters believe that the administration and Congress will try to get both corporate tax reform and individual tax reform done concurrently and work that through in the 2017 budget cycle. Other people have their doubts about that, and I share those doubts. I think it would be more likely that the corporate tax reform, which is easier to accomplish and has a more immediate impact, could be done relatively quickly in the first half of next year, while the individual tax reform will take longer, and I think it will naturally take longer. So that remains to be seen, but for the remainder of my comments, I'm going to delve into the corporate tax reform that's been discussed so far. Many of you probably know that the United States actually has the highest corporate tax rate in the world. That's on a statutory rate. It's 35%. Effectively, if you look at the average of what U.S. corporations pay, it's significantly lower than that. I think it's in the mid-20s or so. That means that a lot of large corporations are paying significantly less than the statutory rate, and many smaller companies aren't able to take advantage of those, you'll call them loopholes or credits, and therefore pay the full rate. But it's pretty clear that the U.S. tax rate is a hindrance to our economic growth, and it needs to be changed in order to ramp that growth up in the future. So President-elect Trump has as one of his highest agenda items, as well as does the Congress, that tax reform is right at the top, along with, of course, the repeal and maybe replacement of the Affordable Care Act. So this is going to get worked on very, very soon. If the corporate tax reform package moves along as everyone hopes it does, it would probably be included in the April 15th budget resolution, and it could be brought before the full Congress and voted on. With only 51 senators, it could be passed. So there's debate about whether tactically it will be done on a partisan basis or bipartisan basis, but if done as a budget resolution, it would probably be partisan, but it could pass with only 51 Senate votes. So that is a possibility. I'll talk a little bit about the differences between the two plans of Speaker Ryan and President-elect Trump. Basically, there's more similarities than differences, but the main difference is the rate itself. Trump would like a 15% corporate rate, and Ryan's plan has a 20% corporate rate. The general belief is it's going to be difficult to get a 15% rate because of just the costliness of it, and so the Ryan plan seems like it probably has a more chance of being the closer to the final package that comes out. In terms of the benefits of corporate tax reform, it's not going to fall evenly throughout all of corporate America, and that's because, as I said, some major corporations take advantage of a lot of benefits that the current system affords. You know, they send, they produce goods overseas. They keep a lot of their revenue and profits out of the U.S., and that creates its own set of problems. But it also benefits them with a lower corporate tax rate, as long as that those profits and revenues don't come back here. So when and if this plan changes, the companies that pay a higher rate today are going to benefit more, while the bigger corporations, and I'm going to name a few, General Electric and Johnson & Johnson are two of the biggest ones, they will not necessarily benefit by corporate tax reform because they're benefiting a lot from the current system today. One of the benefits of a low standard rate, such as 15% or 20%, would be that it would encourage U.S. corporations to build plants here, to keep plants here, and it might also even encourage foreign companies to build plants in the U.S. more than they do already to benefit from our corporate tax system. So the average corporate rate across the world is about 25%, so notice that both of the Ryan plan and the Trump plan are trying to undercut that to get our rate below the world rate to make us even more competitive, which would attract more foreign business as well as keep our own here. And you've also probably heard a little bit about one-time repatriation of foreign profits or foreign cash. That's actually a very interesting but also a somewhat confusing concept, in that what seems to be on the table here is a repatriation of foreign earnings, which actually is a lot larger than just the foreign cash that might be sitting in foreign corporations' subsidiaries. And what it's being spoken of today is a one-time deemed repatriation of foreign accumulated earnings. That's what's on the table. And what the Trump plan would do is would impose a one-time 10% tax on those foreign profits that are outside the U.S., which would be sort of a windfall tax revenue that coming in on a one-time basis. And just as an aside, that one-time windfall of tax revenue could actually be used to fund an infrastructure plan. That's one of the things that's also being discussed. I'm not going to get into that much on today's call. But once that one-time tax is paid, those foreign profits are freed up to go anywhere they want. The hope is that much of that will come back into the U.S. to be used to hire U.S. workers to build and improve U.S. plants. So that, we think, has a pretty near-term potential benefit to the U.S. economic growth forecast. So corporations will be free to move that money anywhere they wanted to after they paid that one-time repatriation tax. Companies that would be benefiting from this would be mainly healthcare companies and technology companies, and a few of the major ones are Microsoft, Apple, Cisco, Amgen, and Qualcomm, just to name a few. Finally, corporate tax reform might actually be done in two steps. Step one might be the infrastructure plan as well as the repatriation and the reduction in the corporate tax rate. And then, as I said, the step two would be the individual tax reform, which we will discuss on a future call in more detail. Finally, this is not all without some risk of not working out as hoped. We believe that it's a good chance that it will work out, that some of this could be done in 2017, that much of it could be done in the 2017 Congress. But the things that are potential risks to it are trade protectionism could get in the way. Again, that goes back to the comment that Greg mentioned earlier. What are going to be the president's priorities? We believe and hope it's on these growth agenda items and not so much on protecting against foreign trade, which is actually a detrimental to economic growth. The strong U.S. dollar, which has been an issue over the past few months, could hinder the growth prospects. Higher rates, which have obviously been in the news lately, and there could always be some global geopolitical upsets that come along as well. So there's always risk involved in such a major change. And those are my comments, and I'll leave it at that unless anybody has any questions or follow-up.
Great, thank you. Thank you, Richard. Jeff, let's go ahead and talk about the bond market a little bit. And obviously, if you could, weave in comments about what you think the Fed's going to do in there as well. But the 10-year, which is a good barometer for the bond market, when we entered November, the 10-year was at 1.83%, which is actually up quite a bit from where we were in the summer. By November 30th, we had jumped all the way to 2.4% on the 10-year. That's just a massive move. And really, when you look at the data, the election day closed, the 10-year was at 185, basically unchanged. So all the move that we saw in interest rates was after the election. And I guess, you know, we talked about how the economy growth was well underway. As we you know, got to the election, but I'm curious as to why it might have been such a pivot point. What was it about the election results that caused yields to bounce as much as they did?
There was a dramatic shift in the psychology. Up until this point, for many years now, I think the business community, the investment community, extrapolated 2% growth out basically infinitum. They just they saw with regulation and the current administration that business growth was going to be somewhat restricted. And as I mentioned earlier, I think the psychology changed that there will be stimulus, there will be economic pro-growth, economic policies that come down the pipe. With that also comes some inflation. So as good as things were in the stock market beginning with the election, things turned sour in the bond market for a lot of the same reasons. It's just the mirror image of things, the other side of the coin, so to speak. So you had dramatic increases in interest rates in government securities. You had municipal securities also went up pretty dramatically with interest rates as people thought about the point that Richard made, tax rates may be coming down, that might make municipals a little less attractive. So you had that combined with the fact that if the economy does pick up and that the Fed is likely to raise more than what's currently anticipated, not a lot. And then you also, at the end of the day, you had the unwinding of a lot of dislocations in the fixed income markets that were brought about by all the quantitative easing, the Fed manipulation, essentially, of interest rates. And people see that as possibly going away. And with that, really what happened was interest rates moved back to a more normal relationship given where inflation is right now and given what we call some of the risk parameters of investing for longer term. So while rates did rise dramatically, it was really more just a return to more normal relationships. The As I mentioned, the other aspect of that is the Fed. We've said all along the Fed's going to raise in December. I think it's 100% probability now in the markets that the Fed raises in December. And then you've got some debate now whether the Fed raises two times next year, maybe June and again in December. Some people think maybe they raise more. So that's another 50 basis points that you could tack onto short rates. But always remember, short rates, which are controlled by the Fed, is a very different animal than the longer-term rates, which the market controls out at 10 years. So the two can behave somewhat differently. The long end is controlled by inflation. The shorter end is more just controlled by the Fed. So we'll have to see. But my take on things is that rates have risen very dramatically. We're seeing people see value in bonds now at these rates. So it doesn't appear that there's going to be another big dramatic move up at this point until we get a clearer picture of what the Trump administration has in store from a policy standpoint.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. Greg, just in the last few minutes here, I think it's important that we have a brief discussion on the stock market. And for the month of November, pretty solid month. S&P 500, which represents U.S. large caps, up 3.7%. International stocks actually did not fare as well. They were actually negative for the month, down 2.3%. And I know you talked about small caps quite a bit on our discussion regarding the economy. Small caps had an amazing month, up 11.1%. And much like we saw on bonds, the election sort of served as a pivot point for the returns that we saw during the month. Give us your comments on the month and maybe just kind of briefly where we're going forward.
Yeah, I think it really was a good month. And last couple of months when we've done this report, it's been the international equities that have actually been in the positive territory, and we're the ones that are either flat or negative. And I think what probably explains the negative returns in the international area are probably the stronger dollar probably had an impact on that. But the Dow was up actually quite a bit at almost 6%, 5.9, as you pointed out, the S&P 3.7. But the general trend, again, has been the smaller the stock or smaller the capitalization stock, the better it's performed. So, you know, S&P, like you said, 3.7, mid-caps, and this is all the S&P indices, 8%, and then small cap 600 at 12.6%. Looking at the sectors, we had pretty much all, most of them in positive territory, with financials posting an outstanding 13.9%, followed by industrials at about 8.9%. Energy up 8.4% for the month, materials 6.9%, consumer discretionary at 4.7%, telecommunication services at 3.6%, and healthcare at just under 2%. The four negative sectors: information technology was down 0.3%, the newly created real estate sector was down 3.7%, and that's been a general trend for the last couple of months. Anything that was paying a high dividend has been performing extremely well, and at one point, the real estate investment trust area was up something like 20%, and a couple of months ago, that began to turn, and you're seeing that trend continue right now. Consumer staples were down about 4.3%, and utilities, again, that are higher paying dividend at 5.4% on the negative. The smaller cap, again, like I said, clear winners, and I think, again, that's tied to the economy, so the leverage is working in that favor, and at least as far as can see, the one interesting thing, and we talked about the VIX index on this before, which is the volatility index, and it kind of captures the short-term fear of investors in the market. That actually declined by about 22% for the month. So that was an interesting move there. That's about it.
All right, Greg, thank you so much for your comments. Good month. And please join us next month. We're going to have a special call on January 10th where we'll review 2016 and also give everyone our outlook for 2017. Please join us then. Again, remember, not January 3rd. It'll be January 10th. Thank you so much.